Hi, Bob.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm glad you agreed to talk about this hot topic of growth, or at least a topic that we want to make hot.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk all about economic growth, about why we want it and how to get it. First, I guess we should introduce ourselves. I'm Will Wilkinson at the Cato Institute, and go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm Bob Lighten. I'm the Vice President here at the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City and also a Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution.
Now, when did you move out to Kansas City?
About 5 years ago full-time, but I've been affiliated with Brookings off and on in my career for probably over two decades.
Well, you know, I was born near Kansas City.
Small world. I hope you
know. It is a small world. I'm from Independence originally.
Every Truman country, but somehow you moved in a different political direction.
I certainly did. Well, Bob, what we want to talk about today is an article that you and Carl Schramm wrote in The American called The Growth Solution, and I understand that this is, highlights themes from your upcoming book, Better Capitalism?
Yes, actually, Carl and I were privileged to have Will Ballmer, professor at NYU, do a previous book called Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism. It's a book that came out from Yale Press in 2007. And Carl and I are now working on the sequel called Better Capitalism. I think you can probably guess what the sequel to that would be. But we're in the process of writing it, and in the course of things, authors like to get out their preliminary thoughts and articles. And that's what Carl and I have done. So it's in The American in the current issue. I guess it's the July-August issue.
Can you, in a nutshell, say what the theme of good capitalism, bad capitalism was for our viewers?
Yes. The sort of conventional view of capitalism is that it is monolithic, that it's a form of economic governance that prizes private property. But other than that, people sort of assume that once you have private property, that's it. It comes in one form. It won. Communist loss, and that's the end of the game. But the theory or the theme of our book is that actually it's a lot more complicated. If you look around the world, there are roughly 200 countries around the world, and the nature of capitalism differs in most of these countries. And we end up putting the kinds of capitalism into four buckets, three of which are good to great, and one of which is bad. And the bad bucket is oligarchic capitalism, where essentially all the power and money is concentrated in the hands of a few. You see it in Africa and Latin America. You see it in large parts of the Middle East, obviously in Russia. And then the various forms of other capitalism that have all demonstrated the ability to grow are state-guided capitalism, what we call big firm or managerial capitalism, and the final form being entrepreneurial capitalism. And talk about how the United States is the leading exemplar of a country that both mixes entrepreneurial and managerial capitalism.
Excellent. And so the better capitalism will be arguing for what?
It will be arguing for how you maintain this unique blend of managerial and entrepreneurial capitalism the United States has somehow come up with in the post-war period, and how you continue it through the rest of the 21st century in a way that maximizes growth and improves living standards for all of us.
All right, well, let's get into your article and talk about growth a little bit, about why we want it so much. Not everybody thinks it is such a good idea. A lot of people think that, you know, our form of economic organization is going to turn the earth into a burnt cinder, like, you know, next Friday or something. But setting that sort of stuff aside, what's the benefit of growth? Why do we want the economy to be growing constantly? Why isn't, like, how wealthy we are right now good enough?
Well, if we want to improve our living standards, and virtually everybody does, there's only one way to do it, and that is to grow. You need, in other words, a larger pie to make everybody better off. Now, as you said, there are some people out there who think that, that growth should not be an objective, that in essence we get sated or with a certain amount of goods, and that we ought to quit striving for more material improvement. That may be true of maybe a small minority of our population, but I look around our country, and there are a lot of people who are in the middle class or lower middle class that certainly would not agree with that statement. They want to be better off, and I suspect even a lot of people that we would call upper middle class, they want to be better off too. And the only way you can do that and make everybody happy about having more a better standard of living is to grow the size of the pie, and that's true for us, and it's true for the rest of the world.
Yeah. So I mean, it's really. I mean, I'm obviously the wrong guy to like be the growth skeptic because I'm kind of a dogmatist about trying to maximize growth rates. But for me, the argument's pretty easy, which is that you know other things equal, higher average levels of income mean that people are going to have more opportunities. They're going to do a better job of realizing their potentials. They're going to be healthier. They're going to live longer. Even there's good evidence that they'll even be more subjectively satisfied with the way that their life is going. You add all that stuff together, and it's you know pretty appealing.
It's pretty appealing, and it's pretty obvious. Although there is, as you imply, there is a counter literature out there that claims that the growth doesn't make us any happier. There's a new book out, by the way, on this subject, which is actually very well done by Arthur Brooks, who's actually the new president of ABI, which was just announced this week. His book is called Gross National Happiness, and for our watchers out there, I strongly recommend the book. And the thesis of his book confirms what you just said, Will, that by and large, growth is good for all of us.
Well, okay, let's talk a little bit about, because this is something that I often run into when I'm being an evangelist for growth, which is just people kind of stare at you blankly when you start talking about what you need to do to increase growth because it's not obvious how economic growth works. And sort of my understanding from the growth literature is that basically you get economic growth by increasing the productivity of labor. You increase the productivity of labor by having technologies that help people do more in less time. And you get those innovations from having a certain set of incentives for people to come up with those innovations. And that's kind of the story in a nutshell. But do you want to home in on that and expand it a little?
I'd say two things. I think that's about 80% right. It's true also that if you invest in more capital equipment, more machines, more buildings, and so forth, that will help you grow because obviously it pays to work. You're going to be more productive with a computer than you are with a pencil. Mm-hmm. So obviously the more computers you have in a society will be more productive. And economists call that computer stuff machines that make other machines and so forth, they call those capital goods. And so you certainly can benefit with capital investment. But by and large, economists who have looked at the issue of growth confirm just what you said, and that is the lion's share of growth is produced by taking whatever resources you have in any given moment, using them better, finding different ways to mix things, and people becoming more productive over time is the way to get growth. So that's certainly one way to look at it. Now, if you're prepared, I'm willing to talk about another way to get growth. So I'll launch right into it. It sort of follows from this book that we did, Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism. If you think about the United States economy coming out of World War II, we were what Carl and Will and I talk about as we were a managerial economy in the sense that big labor, big government, big firms were what drove our economy. It was the age of GM when the president of GM could say what was good for General Motors was good for the country. We had big steel, we had big aluminum companies, and we have big bureaucracies, whether in government or whether in private firms. That took us through the early 1970s, and there were virtues to big bureaucracies because they could mobilize a lot of capital, they had a lot of financial wherewithal to finance R&D. But our economy sputtered in the 1970s, we would argue, not just because energy prices went up, but because our big firms ran out of gas. And just like bureaucracies, wherever they are, they run up against innovation walls. The non-invented here syndrome, the committees, all the problems with bureaucracies we know about. And what the United States successfully did, and it's really one of the most amazing stories, actually, in the last 50 years, is that we morphed from a managerial economy to an entrepreneurial economy where, starting in the late 70s and continuing in the 80s and 90s, it was the new firms. It was not only the Microsofts and the Apples and the Intels, but Walmart, Oracle, you name them. It turns out that today, I think of the 100 top companies on the Fortune 100 list, I think 75 of them were not here in 1970, were not on that list in the 1970s. So we morphed from these big bureaucratic firms into entrepreneurial firms. And I would argue that it was through those entrepreneurial firms that we got a lot of that technological change and that productivity you're talking about. In other words, it wasn't just the IT or the information technology, the computers, which a lot of technical economists write about.
Right.
It was those new firms that brought forth the kinds of technologies we're talking about right now. I mean, this blocking pen is working on Windows and all the software and the computers and the Apples and all the PCs. All
this
that
technology
stuff.
Has to be in a form that's easy for people to use.
Exactly.
Right? It has to be a usable tool in order to get the productivity gain from it. Yeah.
Yes, and it was when it became usable that we were able to flatten organizations, squeeze out a lot more productivity out of existing organizations. And what brought us those new tools, ironically, was not IBM. IBM was important, but it was all those new companies that I mentioned. And we in the United States have been able to nurture the formation of these entrepreneurial companies, and that, we would argue, has been the major engine of growth in the last 20 years or so.
Well, let's dig a little bit deeper down into that, because my more or less informal economic education came from when I spent a number of years at the Mercatus Center at George Mason, spent a lot of time around Austrian economists who have an emphasis on entrepreneurship, but also around the what's sometimes called the new institutional school. And these are these guys emphasize that the rules of the game really matter, right? What sort of laws, regulations, political structures and this is basically the thesis of your good capitalism, bad capitalism. There's not one kind of structure of market organization. There's lots and lots of different structures that create lots and lots of different kinds of incentives to create different kinds of organizations and firms. So what characterizes a system of institutions that's really amenable to entrepreneurial activity and to the rapid creation of new firms, the ability to spot a market opportunity and to move quickly to capitalize on it? What do you need institutionally to make that happen?
Well, I think it really boils down to three categories of things that are pretty obvious when you think about it. Number one, you've got to have an institutional structure that makes it easy for new firms to form and become legal and recognized. So entry costs have to be low. In the United States, fortunately, that's very true. In fact, today in the age of the internet, you can form a business probably in 30 minutes. Number two, there have to be incentives to grow once you form the company. So you can't tax people too much. You've got to have property rights. They can't have too strong of property rights because otherwise they become minefields for new entrants. But by and large, people have to know that if they start an enterprise and they hit it big, that they can keep what they've got. Otherwise, they don't have an incentive to grow. That also means that you don't want a lot of impediments to growth. For example, in Europe, one of the major reasons that they've had problems. They have inflexible labor markets, and once you hire somebody in Europe, it becomes difficult to fire them. And in the quest for job security, Europe has made it difficult, actually, for the formation of new firms, because if you're a new firm and you know that you can't move your labor force around, you can't accommodate the size of your labor force to, let's say, the existing demands out there, then you're not going to hire anybody to begin with, and then you're not even going to start the firm.
Yeah.
So you've got to have institutions that reward growth and make growth possible. So that's the second category of things. And then the final thing is, once you've got the winners, you've got to make sure that there's continual pressure on the winners to keep innovating. You don't want them to become happy, fat, and lazy and quit innovating. And so that means you need some antitrust enforcement. But by and large, you need an open economy. Because I think one of the things I've become convinced of during my life, that I've been an antitrust enforcer, Forbes, yeah. There's a limit to antitrust. The ultimate way to ensure competition is open borders and lots of competition, and that keeps everybody on the toes.
I just want to, because I know a lot of people at this point will be have a certain thought in their mind about high growth, which is that you have to choose between, because you were talking about, you know, managerial capitalism, and a lot of people think, and when you talk about the way that labor markets are inflexible in much of Europe, the reason that's the case is often because the government and the voters are trying to put in place policies that assure a certain kind of stability for workers, to sort of guarantee a certain kind of welfare. So there's people often think that there's a kind of trade-off between having a high level of growth and having a economy that's managed in a way that is going to maximize the welfare of workers. And a point that I like to make is that these are actually really conceptually separable, that you can kind of have sort of crazy buckwild laissez-faire. You can engineer your basic institutions to generate innovation and growth at a maximal level, and then you can take care of the social insurance functions and redistributive functions afterwards. And it's better to do it after you've maximized the size of the pie, rather than trying to sort of build your distributive outcome into the structure in the first place.
Yep, I certainly agree with that. And let me just sort of elaborate on it. One of the things you've suggested is that some people may believe that there's a growth-stability trade-off. Mm-hmm. That the faster you grow, the more unstable people will be because you've got a lot of churning. And by the way, our labor force churns tremendously. As you know, somewhere between one-fourth and one-fifth of our labor force turns over every year. And so there is a feeling that if we grow too much or too fast, that a lot of people will lose their jobs and they'll become obsolete, they'll fall down the income ladder and so forth. There doesn't have to be that kind of trade-off. I would argue that there needs to be a certain amount of instability because you need people to have incentive to continue innovating. But at the same time, you do need some sort of safety net so that people at least have some security that they, if they try and fail, that they can get back up on their feet. So I'll give you an example. We have bankruptcy laws in this country.
Right.
All right. And one of the good things about bankruptcy laws is it lets you start over again. And in fact, if you go to Silicon Valley or other hotbeds of innovation in the United States, you'll find that having failed has can become a badge of honor. there are some places where venture capitalists will not finance you unless you've actually failed and learned the lessons of failure. That is not true in most of the rest of the world. If you go bankrupt or you fail, in most of the rest of the world, you have a badge of shame. And of course, the worst case is there are stories of people committing suicide when they fail. And we have the opposite culture. Now, it's not universal in the United States. There are parts of this country, I would say, maybe a lot of it, maybe here in the Midwest and between the coasts, where you don't have as much entrepreneurial vigor as you maybe have on some of the coasts, where failure can still have some of the stigma to it. But nonetheless, viewed as a large, sort of a general as a general proposition, the United States tolerates failure and has a safety net that allows you to bounce back. I'll give you another example. We have unemployment insurance. We've had it since the Depression. We have a system of what's called trade adjustment systems. You get displaced by imports and so forth. You're supposed to get retraining. Now, in some of my other writings, I've actually criticized the trade adjustment systems program because I think too often what we end up doing is having government retraining for jobs that really are not there. So there's no incentive to go into a program to get retrained. So I've argued in other places for a program of wage insurance. And the idea is if you lose a job and you fall down the income ladder, that the government would help you by subsidizing some portion of your wage loss once you get a new job. But the key is you have to get a new job in order to get some of this insurance. But the bottom line is that some kind of safety net I think is important, but you don't want the safety net to drag down growth. You don't want it to encourage laziness, and that's the trick. That's the challenge for policy, is to find that precise kind of safety net that's going to act as a trampoline and get people back into the labor force and working productively after something bad has happened.
Yeah, and there's, I think you really strongly suggest that there's a that getting the institutions right, you know, helps people develop the kind of taste for risk that leads to innovation. Right? If people become terrified of the downside of risk, then you'll get a lot less risk taking, and then you'll also get a lot less innovation.
That's exactly right.
So, but at the same time, you don't want to sort of give people the sense that a certain level of comfortable living is guaranteed no matter what you do, because you want them to have the motivation to supply their best efforts.
That's
so,
right.
So yeah, that is I think that's in some ways that's the holy grail of economic policy, is to try to find that sweet spot.
That's right. And so let's talk about another sweet spot problem,
yeah,
which is very current as we talk. We're talking here, and I guess right before the presidential election gets underway, but one of the hot issues in the campaign is going to be about health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things here at Coughlin that we've heard lots of anecdotes about is you've got your typical worker in, let's say, a big firm, and I'll leave out the name of the firm, but there are a lot of workers in this category, let's say 35, 45 years old, who they may have a bright idea for starting a new company, but they are deathly afraid of leaving the existing firm,
yeah,
because they may have a pre-existing health condition and they can't get health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the absence of a well-functioning health insurance market actually is a deterrent, in our view, to entrepreneurial activity. And so, therefore, one of the great challenges is finding a way to fix healthcare in a way that solves that problem, but does it also in a way that doesn't discourage innovation, that doesn't add to ever-increasing costs, and doesn't lead to rationing and so forth. I mean, for example, I'm not a big advocate of having the government take over the entire healthcare industry as a way of solving this problem. I think the real challenge for policy looking ahead is finding a way to get market incentives to fix the health insurance problem so that proverbial worker who may be stuck at X company and wants to start a company doesn't have to fear that they won't lack health insurance when they leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what? Like, healthcare is one of those issues that vexes me completely. Partly because the system that we have is so convoluted, and I can imagine what I think the optimal system is, and it looks so far from what the current system is and so far from being politically feasible that it's hard for me to know exactly what kind of marginal steps that I'd like. I mean, for instance, I'd like actual insurance to be legal.
Right.
Right? For insurance companies to be able to charge people premiums based on their actual, you know, actuarial risk. That's illegal, more or less. So it's very hard to have an insurance market. Also, there's all sorts of barriers to entry in healthcare, right? It's very onerous to become a doctor, right? So there's a scarcity in supply of healthcare providers. The AMA, tries to sue the nurse practitioners every time they try to get the right to write certain kinds of prescriptions and things like that. So there's so many, you can imagine what a flourishing market in health services and insurance would look like, but I have no idea how to get there from here myself.
I'll give you a couple thoughts, and then we can move on to another topic, because we could end up spending hours talking about healthcare.
Yeah.
But by the way, this is a very important subject for growth, and I think
it is.
And I'll tell you the link, and then I'll give you my quick 2 second thought on what I would do if I could play God on healthcare. The reason why I think it's so important is one of the great crises that is confronting America and will become more evident in the decades to come is the so-called fiscal entitlement problem. The baby boomers retiring, getting access to Social Security and Medicare. Under the current structure of those programs, there's no way the U.S. government's going to be able to afford this.
Right.
And everybody who's been following this knows this, so far our political leaders have not tackled it. Well, this has huge implications, obviously, for entrepreneurship and growth. Because if we end up keeping the current structure of the healthcare system and the benefit structure, taxes would have to be probably so high to finance it that they would crowd out a lot of private sector activity and we'd kill off growth. So we've got to find a way to address this healthcare problem if we're going to address the entitlement problem. So here's my thought for the day.
Okay.
one of the reasons why costs go up so much in healthcare, and they have been, is because of health insurance. Health insurance basically rewards all kinds of procedures, whether or not they save costs. And in fact, to the contrary, they give incentives for ever more expensive MRIs, CAT scans, mm-hmm. you name it, because insurance pays for it. What we need in a system of healthcare, in my view, is for consumers to be confronted with more of the cost of healthcare so they'll have an incentive to shop. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people who invent new technologies will have an incentive to try to save money. Right now, those incentives do not exist. And so ideally, what I would like to see is as a healthcare system that had catastrophic coverage for everybody, because that's really what we're worried about.
Right.
And then for sort of routine care, I'd like to have a system with what I call progressive deductibles, so that low-income people who can't afford healthcare, they may pay the $15 copay, but for mm-hmm. higher-income people, they should be paying a lot more money out of their pocket for healthcare.
Yeah.
So that they have an incentive to shop around. And until people have an incentive to shop around, we're never going to get this thing fixed.
Well, there's no prices.
And that, by the way, that's exactly right.
It's a huge problem. Like, if I call up my doctor and say, how much is it for, my appendix is inflamed. How much for an appendectomy?
Right.
They'll look at you like you're crazy. It's like, how much will your health plan compensate us for an appendectomy? Right, you need prices. That's how there's just no market.
There's no market, exactly. So you don't know the prices and you don't know the quality, and there's no incentive to produce that information until people are actually paying for it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I want there to be you should be able to, go on Google Health and, put in your zip code, say what the procedure it is that you want, and it's going to give you a list of all the, licensed, doctors or practitioners in your area, and gives you what their prices are. And then it's also going to give you basically like the Amazon reputation sort of thing.
Yep.
You can have a bunch of reviews of all these doctors. Oh, yeah, this guy botched my appendectomy. This guy, I don't know how he can afford to give such cheap appendectomies, and I can't even see the scar, right? That's the information you want. And so that people gravitate towards the efficient providers of the service. You want that competition to create the pressures that bring down prices and bring up quality, and we have none of those incentives.
That's exactly right. And until we fix the insurance system, we won't get those incentives. So that's a long way of ending a very important topic. But it's by the way, it's crucial to growth, because we will
eat up all the money in the system.
We'll eat up the whole GDP if we don't solve this problem.
Well, what other things can you, in your article, you have a number of initiatives to help bring up growth rates. And you mentioned, I hadn't known this, and this was interesting, that in the 60s under Kennedy, the Democrats specifically had a high growth platform. They were aiming at 5%, annual growth, which is a lot better than we do these days. And they actually, achieved it for a little while. What kinds of things could we do now to bring up growth rates, in your opinion?
Well,
other than that, so the health was one piece of that. What are some of your other pieces of that puzzle?
Okay, so I think at the top of my list would be fixing immigration, but in a way that maybe a lot of people who are watching don't readily think about. And that mm-hmm. is, I would dramatically increase the opportunities for high-skilled immigrants or immigrants who want to come here and get an education in science, technology, math, and engineering, the so-called STEM degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I would say pretty much have an open-door policy, subject to national security concerns, of course, mm-hmm. but have an open-door policy and import as much skill as we can get. In fact, I would go so far, Carl and I have written this, Carl Schramm, co-author of my book, we've written that if an immigrant comes to the United States, gets a STEM degree at a university, whether it's a BA, a master's, or a PhD, they automatically get a green card at that point. We don't want them with a short-term H-1B visa where they're over here for 6 years and then they have to go home. We want them to be able to stay because of another study we funded here at Kauffman,
mm-hmm.
which found that 25% of all the successful high-tech startups in the last decade were either founded or co-founded by an immigrant. That is far out of proportion to the immigrant share of the population, which is roughly half that. And mm-hmm. so for all those people out there who are worried about immigrants taking your job, what I would say is that the more high-skilled immigrants we can have come here, they'll create more jobs mm-hmm. by the formation of the new firms and the new technologies that are inside their heads and that we're going to train them for. And so I think this is the single, hands-down, most important thing that we can do to ensure that our country will continue growing rapidly in the future.
Well, okay, so here's an objection to this, which I've heard from Barack Obama, for example. Which is, he admits that we need more high-skilled workers. But the problem is that we're just not educating Americans well enough. And so he says, okay, I'll, sort of hesitantly accept raising the quota on H-1B visas for the time being. But really what we ought to be doing is making sure that we're producing a lot more sort of engineers and computer sciences and mathematicians domestically. Why not put the focus there rather than benefiting, foreigners?
Okay, and the short answer to that is clearly we need to do both. Mm-hmm. And in the short run, it's going to be hard to change our educational system. We all know how hard that is, and that's, by the way, going to be my next item on the list. So clearly, we have to do more to educate our workers in the United States, but that's going to be a long-term thing. In the meantime, we ought to get as many skills from as many people around the world who want to come here. There's no point in cutting off our nose to spite our face. This is only going to hurt us, and it's not going to help us by keeping out these people. And in fact, I would argue that one of the major reasons why American firms now want to outsource their activities to foreign countries is that they go look for talent in other countries. Mm-hmm. Why not have the talent come here, and we'll have more of an incentive for firms to use foreign workers who are now in our shores rather than have them go abroad. So, mm-hmm. ironically, a lot of the people concerned about outsourcing, the way to solve that is to import more people.
Here's another objection that was made very, very forcefully to me yesterday because I did a commentary on Marketplace where I said, hey, you know what? What the leading cause of increasing wage inequality is, according to the mainstream consensus of labor economists? Well, the reason is that productivity of higher skilled workers or for more highly educated workers has improved more quickly than for lower skilled workers, and that's exacerbated by the fact that the education system isn't producing higher-skilled workers fast enough to keep up with demand. One way to keep supply and demand in, more or less aligned would be to let in more skilled workers from outside. And in fact, one effect of that would be to bring down the wages, though, of high-skilled workers, which would also bring down wage inequality. But when I mentioned this as a way of bringing down inequality, I was accused of wanting to destroy the middle class. Got a lot of emails from people with PhDs who said, I can't find a job. Why are you, trying to take food out of my children's mouths? How do you respond to that kind of objection?
Well, actually, I think rather than focus on, let's say, upper income versus lower income and mm-hmm. all that and trying to fix the inequality problem in sort of a static world, what I'd rather do is try to grow the pie for everybody. And so I would view the primary case for importing more high-skilled laborers as not necessarily cure the inequality problem, but as a way mm-hmm. to generate more future jobs for more people and more income. And that's the major reason for it. And that the best way to cure the inequality problem is let's go to the bottom part of the income distribution and let's fix that. Mm-hmm. All right? And I think ultimately, I think we can both agree, ultimately the only way to get low-skilled workers earning more is to educate them more.
Mm-hmm. So how do we do that?
Okay, so I will admit that I don't have all the perfect answers for people who are already in the labor force. But I do know one thing, that for kids now in school and for kids that are about to come in school, I know one thing, that we are not going to fix education in this country until we have our educational system run more like a private enterprise, where people get rewarded for being more productive, for being more entrepreneurial, where principals have the freedom to hire and fire bad teachers, where teachers have incentives to make more money if they do better and get their kids performing better on tests and graduating high school and doing all the things we want. We have a bureaucratic 1950s-style education system that is more like the Soviet Union and less like the 21st century that needs to be. I know this is something that the federal government can't fix all at once, but I can tell you that in the few places actually around the country where we've had progress, when you think of some of the big cities, there are places where the mayor has taken over the school system, all right, either because the state has told them to or because the mayor has done it on its own initiative, and they're instituting at least some kinds of these reforms that we've talked about. You look at New York City, you look at Philadelphia, now in New Orleans, for example, we have a perfect test bed for competition. We have lots of charter schools in New Orleans. Not all of them are going to work out, but one thing I can feel confident of is that New Orleans is going to be a lot better off by having this competition. And by the way, the flooding in of Teach for America of kids who are now teaching, these whiz kids that are now coming out of college to teach, you're going to have, I think, a lot more vibrancy in the teaching market in New Orleans than you ever would have had pre-Katrina. And so, ultimately, this country has got to fix education in a pro-competitive, in a pro-incentive-compatible way. Otherwise, we are never going to solve the income distribution problem at the bottom of the scale.
Well, I noticed in your article that you did not mention, say, like school vouchers or tax credits or the kinds of things that analysts here at Cato recommend for creating something more like a market in education. Why did you leave that out?
Well, I guess first there's limits to how much you can cram into an article with the editors. But I guess my gut feel is that while, you know, in a perfect world, I would be all for vouchers. Mm-hmm. It seems like in a lot of places around the country, the public doesn't seem willing to buy them. But they are willing to tolerate charter schools, which is a second-best approach. And by the way, for a lot of people don't understand, charter schools are still public schools. Mm-hmm. They're chartered by local authorities, but the advantage of them is they're not under the thumb of the local school bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And so you get a lot more experimentation. Like here in Kansas City, I think we have 17 or 18 charter schools. Where you are in D.C., by the way, I think something like 20% of all the schools are chartered.
Yeah, they're proliferating pretty quickly, and we need something. It's like the worst urban education system in the Northeast.
And people are voting with their feet to go to these schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things, though, that a lot of charter schools confront is that they don't get on a per-pupil basis the money that often goes to the other traditional public school. And so they don't get 100% of what it costs. And there are technical reasons for this, but I think they're underfunded. And I think we ought to level the playing field more for charter schools. So the bottom line is, yes, I'd like a free market on the demand side. It's where the people can shop around vouchers. But if you can't do that, I'll take it on the supply side where we have charter schools.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why I think, I mean, this is a big issue for, I've actually been working on a long project about inequality myself, and my my emphasis is the thing that really matters is that there's, you know, a whole segment of the population that really does seem to be trapped at the bottom, and that poverty keeps reproducing itself generation after generation, and that's a real travesty. And there's things we can do about that. And one of the problems is the status quo system of education, which, despite the fact that it's a public system, is sort of like an apartheid system. Public schools in wealthy communities are just qualitatively vastly different than public schools in poor communities. And there are sort of very actually intuitive sort of political reasons why that's the case. And until there's a restructuring of the incentives, we're just going to keep getting this more or less segregated system of public education. Just sort of like being like, we need to make a big push of funding for poorer schools doesn't really work, partly because you need a bunch of surrounding infrastructure and institutions around the schools that aren't necessarily publicly provided. And without those, it's not going to work. They're just not going to be as good. And so I despair of seeing something that really has a long-term benefit in the absence of the kind of mechanisms that in general bring up the quality of goods, which is market competition. Now, people think that I sound like a crazy market fundamentalist, but that's really the only way I understand that the quality of goods for poorer consumers gets better over time. And so I want a price system. I want I want a competitive market in education. And so I like all of your ideas as sort of intermediaries, and I think there's no way of getting where I'd like to go without a big sort of change in people's sense of, you know, how the world works or what, you know, sort of equality requires of us. But I also don't think we're going to make a lot of progress in bringing people up from the bottom until we can do something more dramatic.
Okay, so
I'm sorry, that was a that was a long rant.
Well, no, but you know, it's so easy to get full of despair and think like we can't do anything until we get massive revolution. But you know, I've been given a lot of thought to this with my colleague Eric Coughlin, and you uttered the magic word. The word's called incentives. Mm-hmm. And if you get incentives right, people change behavior. That's one of the things we know as economists. So let's go back to the urban school that's got all these problems.
Right.
One thing we may want to experiment with is incentives for teachers that pay them more the higher the number of kids that go on to college. And so...
But doesn't that disadvantage teachers who have lower-income students?
Well, what you can do, I'm talking about targeting this only for schools, let's say, that have lower-income population.
Okay.
So you can target these. So in other words, I'm not in favor of giving incentives to, you know, the rich suburban school kids. That's not where our problem is. Our problem is in schools with low-income populations. Mm-hmm. So you could design a system that rewards teachers and pays them more. And I'm not talking about as a subsidy. I'm talking about as a supplement.
Right.
They would get additional bonuses the more of their kids that ultimately graduate high school. That's one idea. A second idea, there's an economist at Harvard named Roland Fryer, very innovative guy, who is experimenting now with just very modest payments for students who do well. And you don't even have to pay them in cash. So you can pay them in cell phone notes by giving kids cell phones, and the better you do in school, the more cell phone notes you get. Or, for example, there's a network of schools called KIPP schools, Knowledge is Power schools.
Yeah.
They've been featured on 60 Minutes twice. They pay kids in KIPP dollars, and what KIPP dollars are useful for are for trips or school-sponsored events, but they're basically very limited rewards, and it's been demonstrated that kids respond to these things. And so what I would argue for, until we get the nirvana of perfect competition between schools and vouchers and all that, you can, within the public school system, incentivize teachers and kids to do better. Now, let's at least start there.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I mean, I'm for anything that I think that will make a marginal change. But there's a lot of resistance just to offering incentives at all. Isn't this sending kids the wrong message? Shouldn't they value education for its own sake? And so on and so forth. And then there are a lot of people who will cite this evidence from behavioral economics that by actually trying to offer cash incentives, you undermine people's intrinsic motivation. And so, you know, it seems to me that there's a lot of resistance and even some sort of theoretical backing for opposition to offering sort of clearer incentives for performance.
Well, certainly the KIPP schools have rebutted that. They've been dramatically successful. Now, you can argue, of course, it's a self-selected group of kids, which they are. Mm-hmm. In order to get to a KIPP school, your parents have to go through an interview, and you have to be very dedicated. You have to go to school from 7:30 to 5 and so forth. And also, by the way, Saturdays and even sometime during the summer. So these kids work really hard.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would argue just the reverse. You've got kids now in second or third grade in lower-income schools that get potentially trapped very quickly into gang violence and so forth, and that's the only culture that they're going to know when they grow up to be 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be lucky to survive if they make it to 18. And I would argue that before you get to the internal motivation, the kids have to have at least some extrinsic reward. So the idea would be to jumpstart their incentive or their desire structure. So that if they know and they get praise and they can see the praise in a way that they know, that they understand, whether it's a yeah. dollar or a cell phone or whatever. As long as they learn that they can start to do well, after a couple of years, you don't need these incentives anymore, because at that point the kid becomes. They know that they get that learning has its own value, but they'll never get on the ladder of success unless you start somewhere. And so I would argue you need something as a jump start to get these kids at least on the track toward success.
Well, I can't disagree with that. Let's talk about a couple other of your elements in your formula for growth. One of the things you mentioned, shifting gears radically, I think, is a reform of the intellectual property system. What's holding growth back now in the way intellectual property is encoded in the law?
Okay, so really we're talking about patents and copyrights.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make it very clear that if you come up with a real original innovation, or you write a book or whatever, I'm all for copyrights and all for patents. I mean, you have to have a system of property rights to reward people for their creativity. But you can go too far.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start rewarding and start giving out patents for just blatantly obvious things, what that means is that people can get government awarded monopolies and impede the ability of future entrepreneurs to be successful. In effect, mm-hmm. they can blackmail anybody else who comes into the market.
Right.
And this becomes a very serious problem. I think it's a serious problem now. The patent office today gets 400,000 applications a year. That's up from like 100,000 several years ago. They are literally overwhelmed with
yeah.
patent applications. And as a result, there's a huge backlog. And there's a temptation when you have a backlog just to sit there and rubber stamp and give out patents.
Yeah.
That is not good. That is not going to promote growth in the long run. What we need is a way to attack this problem so that only the truly original stuff gets patented. Now, you can do that either through a legal procedure, which has been being debated on the Hill. It's actually dead as we talk right now, but it'll probably mm-hmm. be taken up next year. And there are various legal reforms to make it easier to challenge patents and not have to spend so much money on litigation and so forth. And they all may be worth trying, although the politics of this is that the pharmaceutical industry is very much opposed to this, while the software industry generally is for it as a result of the stalemate on the Hill.
Yeah.
Now, there is an alternative way of doing this and solving this problem, and we mentioned it very briefly in the article.
Mm-hmm.
It's to use what's called peer-to-peer technology, or to harness the wisdom of crowds to judge the validity of patents.
Mm.
So there's an experiment now actually going on at the Patent and Trademark Office that was thought out by some very clever people at New York Law School. One whose name comes to mind is Beth Novak. And what she has suggested, and actually the PTO is doing right now, is that for a certain class of innovations, the Patent Office is in effect setting up a wiki and allowing the public to comment mm-hmm. on whether or not this innovation is original or not. And in essence, harnessing the wisdom of crowds.
Yeah.
And really
interesting.
It's a fascinating way, because basically what it says is to the poor patent examiner who's this flooded with applications, there's no way they can know everything about everything. Why not get people who actually know something to comment on these applications? And so I think one thing that bears watching is how this experiment plays out, because it may turn out that the public knows a lot more than that individual patent executive.
Well, there's a lot of people who, you know, invest a lot of time and energy in a particular area, so they know a lot about prior art.
Yes.
So if you are an engineer who works in a certain, in a certain industry, you might know a lot about, certain kinds of materials engineering or something like that, that people at the patent office might not know about, and it'd be useful to use that guy's knowledge.
Yes.
And I think that's a great idea. I mean, and one thing that always occurs to me, I mean, my friend and colleague here at Cato, Tim Lee, works on some of these IP issues, and one of the things that I'd seen from him is that different kinds of patents tend to have different kinds of economic effects.
Yes.
in the end. And for me, the justification of property rights of any kind depends, rests ultimately on whether that right tends to make everyone better off. So the rights in real property are justified by the incentives it gives for people to use that property well and wisely, and to use it to produce wealth. That's a good reason for, the reason to divide up a commons into parcels is that the owners of the individual parcels will have an interest in maximizing the productivity of their parcel, right?
Yeah.
So that's the justification for, say, like dividing up, a pasture or a piece of common property. But the justification is always an instrumental one in the end. With intellectual property, what you're trying to do is give people an incentive to sort of go out into the space of infinite possibilities, find something that's useful and it's going to help people, and sort of bring it back. There might be different incentives for different sorts of areas, though, because different kinds of fields have... it takes a different kind of work. So, for instance, chemical patents the estimate of the economic return of having fairly strong patents on new chemicals seems to be fairly high, partly because the investment that you need to try to create a new chemical is very, very high. So if you don't have a strong property right, you're not going to get the R&D into figuring out this new drug or figuring out this new advanced material. The R&D that goes into thinking up an algorithm is a lot different than that. And so it seems that the return from sort of patents on certain kinds of sort of computer technologies, especially when people try to patent sort of techniques in software, tend to be negative, I think. That seems to indicate that the question isn't like whether patents should be weaker or stronger. It's in what areas strong patents actually make us better off and make us worse off, and try to adjust accordingly.
Now, I'm very tempted by that argument, mm-hmm. and I think logically it makes a lot of sense to try to differentiate by industry. The problem I think we run up against is the political economy problem,
mm-hmm.
Where if you set up a system that has differential property protection by industry, obviously you'll give incentives for people to gain it.
Mm-hmm.
And to classify their innovation in the box that gets the most protection. Now,
right.
I think there are ways to address that. It's just that we have to recognize that is a problem. It may kill the idea, but I think this whole idea of differential property rights is something that's worth exploring. So I agree.
Well, let's talk about one more thing before we end, and that's taxes. At the beginning, you mentioned that you don't want to tax people too much in a way that's going to stymie the incentive for them to create new businesses and to grow their businesses. But surely we need to tax people to a certain degree in order to fund the sort of wage insurance that you favor, or the... to ensure that people are able to get access to certain kinds of health insurance. So how high is too high for taxes? How do you know?
Well, we don't know until you play the game. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you, there's such huge controversy about this.
Mm-hmm.
All I can say is I think pretty much everybody who's watching this will agree that you try everything else before you try taxes. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that when we get to entitlements, which is really our biggest problem,
mm-hmm.
I think we're going to have to give a lot more thought to how do you trim benefits because we can't afford them at their current level. And I'm not talking about trimming them for their current population. I think virtually everyone who's talking about entitlement reform
mm-hmm.
is talking about the future generation, whether it's people under 55 or 50 or 40, people that have not grown up under the expectation that people who are in their retirement have. And also under the theory and the fact that future generations, my kids, are going to be richer than I am. And
mm-hmm.
so even though they may not get the exact benefits that I have, they'll have more resources to be able to buy them on their own. So I would favor certainly doing something on benefits before we do something on taxes. And perhaps the most important thing I will do, then I'll go back to taxes. The most important thing, as I said, is to create incentives for cost-saving technology, especially in healthcare, so that we don't even reach the issue of benefit cuts. If I could find a way to slow healthcare inflation, we wouldn't have to go to benefit cuts. And I think the only way we're going to be able to do that, as I said, is to change the deductible system. Yeah. So,
but as it is now, the rate of inflation in healthcare is just racing way ahead of the general rate of inflation.
Yeah, it's been roughly, I think, over the last 20 years, it's been running roughly 4 to 5 percentage points faster than inflation.
And it's not because the quality of that healthcare is getting that much better, that much faster.
No, it's because it's largely because of technology. It, clearly, there's a lot of fraud, waste, and abuse. We know that. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that the major reason for the inflation, as opposed to the existing stock of fraud, waste, and abuse, is continuing technology. By the way, some of which is certainly benefits. I mean, I'm not going to dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, getting back to taxes, I would say that at some point, and I know people will cringe, and maybe, Will, you're going to cringe when I say this, but I think at some point, even with the innovation we may get, and even with any benefits we, and any benefit reductions we get, we're going to need more revenues at some point in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, faced with that dilemma, I would prefer to tax consumption than to tax income.
Mm-hmm.
Taxing income taxes work, taxes effort, and I'd rather tax consumption than reward saving if I'm going to have to tax it all.
I actually agree with you. What I would like is there's a lot of complexities in the political economy of taxation, and but I think a model that I like quite a bit is what gets taxed is your income net of your savings and investments in the year. So then that's a way of sort of approximating a consumption tax. You don't need to tax people at the point of consumption, but you just tax people for their income that they're not saving in or investing. And that encourages a certain kind of, it doesn't discourage people from earning higher incomes in the same sort of way, and it also encourages capital accumulation that could, you know, presumably help the pace of innovation.
That's right. I think the trick from a political economy point of view is, do you replace the entire income tax with a consumption tax of the kind you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
or do you use the consumption tax at the margin and sort of live with the income tax system we have, more or less? I mean, I think politically it's going to be almost impossible to get rid of the income tax. And so I would like to reform it, by the way. I would like to turn the clock back to 1986 with the Reagan tax cut, Reagan tax reform, which
mm-hmm.
was accomplished through bipartisan cooperation and voting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Bill Bradley was a big supporter of Reagan's reform. Unfortunately, over the last 20-some years, the tax code has become so junked up, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that's why everyone hates it. But still, I don't think we're going to be able to get rid of it, even
mm-hmm.
if we reform it and trim it. And so I think at the margin is really what I'm talking about. If we're going to need additional revenues to pay for Medicare in particular, I think I would rather have that financed by some tax on consumption
mm-hmm.
and make an allowance for low-income people, have some kind of offsetting tax reduction for low-income people to offset that. And so that leads us to taxing consumption at the point of consumption
mm-hmm.
if we're going to do it at the margin. Now, if we do it your way and we magically replace income tax system, then sure, we could do it without taxing at the point of consumption. But
mm-hmm.
then we'd have to find a way, in my view, to make it somewhat progressive so that people at the bottom aren't paying essentially the same marginal rate that people at the top are.
Here's a counterintuitive political economy fact, which it seems to be that the more regressive consumption tax system that Europeans have allows for a higher percentage of government spending as a percentage of GDP, partly because it broadens the tax base to such an extent that the people's interest in keeping the tax rate down, there's not a concentrated interest in keeping the tax rate down. When you have a very highly graduated, quite highly progressive income tax system like we have, you end up with a very small portion of the population paying a majority of all the taxes, which makes rich people who pay most of the taxes highly motivated politically to keep the rates lower. And so you actually end up with lower revenue as a percentage of GDP in that kind of system, even though it is more progressive at some level.
That's an interesting argument. I think you're right.
Yeah. But well, just threw that out there. Well, I think actually our time is up. So any concluding thoughts?
No, I guess the only thing just to keep in mind is that as we go ahead in the future and weigh all these various policy options about our economy, whatever we do, let's don't let our eye wander off the growth objective. Let's ask ourselves before we do anything, whether it's redistributive or regulatory, tax or whatever, we should ask ourselves first, what's this going to do to growth? And if it's going to penalize it, is the trade-off worth it?
Well, that is an excellent place to stop, I think. And let me recommend once again to our viewers your article, The Growth Solution in the American. And please check out Bob and Carl Schramm and William Baumol's previous book, Good Capitalism. What's it called again? Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism?
Yeah, Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism.
And I've got it on my shelf, and I keep meaning to get to it, and now I'm going to get to it for sure.
Good. Thanks a lot. You'll love it.
And look forward to the next book.
You'll love it. Thanks so much, Will.
Thanks for coming on.
Okay, great. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.